This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Community amplified.
We're demanding equity. We are demanding justice. We are demanding fairness. We are demanding the seats at the table that we deserve.
What do changes to the Voting Rights Act mean for black voters in Maryland? I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, it's Juneteenth, and we're celebrating, revisiting the 50-year history of AFRAM, which is happening this weekend.
Basically, at Dunbar High School, there was a parent club who was already pushing for cultural arts, and then there was also a soul fest that was happening in Baltimore as well. And kind of those concepts merged a little bit when Norman E. Ross put in this proposal for AFRAM.
And the history of Juneteenth celebrations here in Maryland.
Community festivals that actually had parades and banners and floats in various cities.
That's all coming up next. Good afternoon and welcome to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of the WYPR News Team, which picked up some more awards this week, two more from PIMJA. They were won by Wamboy Kamau. Congratulations to her. Today, it's Juneteenth, and like the rest of Maryland, we have the day off, so we recorded this show throughout the week. Keep that in mind in case any news changes. In just a few minutes, we'll get into the history of Juneteenth and the history of Juneteenth in Maryland specifically. Then we'll hear from some black rock stars. June is also Black Music Month. We'll be passing the mic to a Baltimore rapper and we'll end with a celebration.
You can't really say you're from Baltimore if you've never been to AFRAM.
We're everywhere. Wherever you look in music, black is there. So I feel like celebrating black history with the music is super important and integral for us as a culture. So
AFRAM turns 50. We welcome Baltimore's Summer Signature Festival into its golden decade with more music and some blasts from the past. But first, it's time to vote. Early voting wrapped up yesterday. The primary is on Tuesday. Polls open from 7 in the morning until 8 at night, and that is also the deadline Tuesday at 8 to have your mail-in ballot, if that's how you're voting, postmarked or dropped off at a ballot box. So we wanted to talk about voting rights today, and around the United States, that means something different this year.
The justices invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act.
On April 29th, the U.S. Supreme Court effectively struck down a significant portion of the Voting Rights Act.
In ruling Louisiana's congressional map an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, the court opened the door for GOP-led states to eliminate districts drawn to be majority black.
This was Maryland Governor Wes Moore's response.
What we saw from the Supreme Court was devastating, but it wasn't surprising. I think about it in context where, you know, the Supreme Court just made a decision that I think is one of the most damaging blows to the civil rights movement that we've seen. But the day before that, I signed the Voting Rights Act in Maryland, actually protecting voting rights inside of the state of Maryland.
24 hours before that, lawmakers in Annapolis were celebrating the passage of a landmark bill aimed at protecting voting rights here in Maryland. Right now, Maryland has the highest percentage of black female state lawmakers in the country, more than 18%. Maryland's legislative black caucus is the largest in the nation. Could these changes affect black representation in Maryland? To answer that question, we have two guests. Monica Brooks, president of the NAACP in Wacomico County. Just a few years ago, she worked with the county to dismantle the at-large election system, found to dilute black votes and deny fair representation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We also have William J. Ford, who has spent decades reporting on politics in Maryland for Maryland Matters. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much.
So let's start a bit by explaining what the 1965 Voting Rights Act did to protect voters. Section 2 of it banned any practice that, quote, results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color. William, we'll start with you. What does that decision from the Supreme Court mean for the state of Maryland?
Well, there's been about, I'd say, six other states that did this beforehand. And Maryland lawmakers looked at it, and even advocates said, you know what, the way this Supreme Court is looking, the way that it has ruled on other cases, need to be proactive and protect our voting rights for people of color. Maryland's is ranked as one of the top five states in the country having diverse residents. Matter of fact, maybe more than 50% are people of color. 157 municipalities are in the state, about a third having diverse residents. According to the Maryland ACLU, all white governments. So if you think about Maryland being this diverse state, but you have all white governments in a third of the municipalities having diverse residents, That's one reason they said, we have to change this. And so, first of all, it's an emergency measure, which means once the governor signed it, it's in law. So it'll affect counties and municipal elections that are going on. That's one. Secondly, it's looking to hopefully not take away representation from people of color who seek office, period. And the bill, Senate Bill 255, was sponsored by Charles Sidnor of Baltimore County, is one of the main reasons why he did it.
Now, we look back at some cases to defend black voters in Maryland recently, and we caught up with you, Monica, because you were involved in one of them.
We're demanding equity. We are demanding justice. We are demanding fairness. We are demanding the seats at the table that we deserve.
You head up the NAACP in Wicomico County on the Eastern Shore. In 2023, there were two cases there. How did those cases come about, and how did they change black representation?
Yes. Yeah, so what you're dealing with when you're talking about rural communities, we're leaps and bounds behind what's happening in major cities. So in the 80s, Wicomico County in particular had not had any representation of people of color in our councils. And so they threatened lawsuit. There became a one majority black district. And going forward, there has never been any other person of color at all, pick one, to represent on the councils. With Federalsburg, they had never had a person of color ever in 200 years. So when you're talking about the true diversity that is, as was just mentioned, in this state, and that how that representation has not manifested itself in leadership in our government, there has to be a reason. And so through no other means have we been able to crack that code other than lawsuit.
One Federalsburg resident, Roberta Butler, spoke out after the settlement was reached, and the town offered an official apology.
I'm glad we got this settlement, but in a way, I'm so sad that my parents, my grandparents, my neighbors, they're all gone now. They didn't get to see this day, this history that we made in Federalsburg. What the town was doing was wrong. You say, what's wrong?
And you won this case. How did you feel about it at the time?
Absolutely thrilled and over the moon. At the end of the day, the people have the opportunity to fight for themselves. So that's what happened. The people spoke. We won that suit. We're excited. And it wasn't just that. We had some other things that came as a result of it. A Human Rights Advisory Council was instituted. Meetings with black organizations that the councils have to do. Things like that, that should be normalized, but had to come as a result of this. It's going to be a process of you know, working through all of it. However, it's been great.
Now, given the Supreme Court ruling that came down in April, do you think you could win this case if it were filed again or if it were being argued right now?
No, I highly doubt it. In many ways, when we did long discussion on if we wanted to push forward with this lawsuit, is this what we want to do at this time? Is this what we want to do? We had a sense of urgency, and we were also encouraged by what occurred in Federalsburg. We were cheering with them. We were supporting them. You know, let's go. Come on, Federalsburg. And they got two people in. So we're very glad that we pushed forward in the way that we did, not knowing that these kinds of rights would be repealed so quickly in such a short amount of time. And so today, absolutely not. I don't believe so. So I'm grateful that we had this opportunity to do what we did when we had the opportunity to do it.
William.
Yes. Ms. Brooks mentioned a key phrase, having to go to court. And there's been, you can use voting rights, immigration reform, education. Advocates don't want to sit around and go to court. You know, you got to pay legal fees for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's expensive going to court. Mm-hmm. Some lawyers can charge $500 to say hello. Forgive me for all the lawyers out there, but I'm sorry. It's a high charge. But the point being is that the court is looked at as the last resort, but it appears with this administration that is the only resort. And we have an Attorney General, Anthony Brown, here in Maryland. He's been a part of or co-led and led various suits and amicus briefs because of what's been going on.
So going forward, this question's for both of you. How much do you think, one, the Maryland law that's been passed here after the Supreme Court ruling, but how much do you think that's going to affect black representation in Maryland? Right now, I believe it's 3 out of 10 members of Congress in Maryland are black, maybe a fourth one, given the people who may be winning the race that's currently for the seat currently held by Steny Hoyer. So go up to about 40% of the state's congressional delegation. But that's obviously just one set of lawmakers. How could this affect going forward all across Maryland black representation?
Well, people have to go really vote. I mean, I'll go back to in April when Montgomery County Delegate Greg Wims stood on the House floor and told a short story about Randolph Rudy Kane. Delegate Wims was state NAACP president at the time.
And one of the biggest things we did in that year was we went to Snow Hill down on the Eastern Shore to protest the fact that there had never been a black elected official from the state of Maryland on the Eastern Shore to be in the county and to be here in the state house.
And it took 4 years for Mr. Kane to be able to get elected.
The great Delegate Rudy Kane was elected because of the great work that we, the NAACP and others did, to sue. It took 4 years, but he did become the very first great delegate here in the South.
That was back in 98.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And Delegate Wims has been doing, he's, I think Delegate Wims is about 76. He's been doing this for a few years. So if you just sit back and be like, wow, it was 98.
If you think about how long ago Shirley Chisholm ran for president or Jesse Jackson ran for president or the countless people across this country of color, and to find us in this place where we're still having to fight the good fight. I'm encouraged in the sense that, yes, we won these cases, and it has brought a level of inspiration to people throughout our community. People who literally had that same feeling as my parents when they saw President Obama become president and say, I never thought I would see this happen. On a lower level, we have people saying, wow, I never thought that not only that we could sue and win to start, and two, that we could have that sort of influence and power. And so we have a huge new crop of people running for office through every area of the races this year. So there may not be immediate change, but change is definitely on the horizon. And it is already causing people to see themselves in a light that they had not seen themselves before. So I'm encouraged by it. I'm glad our governor signed that Voting Rights Act into place, which, again, that's something that had to be done. What is going on a federal level about this so-called, fake people on rolls and all of that? All it is an opportunity to get to people's personal information, to see what voters are doing, who they're voting for, what are their parties, all of this personal information, and I think it's just a way to target people. So all of this has just been a ruse to keep certain people in position and to manipulate voting under the guise of we're trying to protect voting.
Monica Brooks is president of the NAACP in Wicomico County and the regional chair of the NAACP on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And William J. Ford is a longtime political reporter with our friends at Maryland Matters. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, sir.
Up next, as we celebrate Juneteenth today, we have a look at its history here in Maryland. I'm Matt Bush, and this is the WYPR News Roundup. Stay with us.
Is classical music just not for you? Well, maybe it's time to be classical curious. Join us Saturday, June 27th at Maryland Hall in Annapolis as WYPR and the Columbia Orchestra present classical music for people with short attention spans, an engaging, humorous, fast-paced concert experience for both newcomers and seasoned listeners. Enjoy a lively program of short works from across the classical repertoire hosted by WYPR's Taylor Holbrooks. Two shows, 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Tickets and more info at WYPR.org.
Maryland Unfolded is a new history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. On the latest episode, we discuss Maryland politics during the Revolutionary War and former poet laureate Lucille Clifton. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Made possible, in part, by Gallagher LLP.
If you face workplace discrimination, you can blow the whistle to an independent agency. But if you work for the federal courts, you don't have the same rights.
They have nowhere to turn. No independent enforcer. No neutral decision maker.
I'm Elsa Chang. Law students are asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on how the courts police themselves. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 here on WYPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
Welcome back. You're listening to WYPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore, the region, and our state. I'm Matt Bush. Today, we mark Juneteenth. The state of Maryland has held Juneteenth as an official holiday since 2022. It celebrates the end of slavery in Texas in 1865, 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by Abraham Lincoln. How slavery came to an end is a long and messy reality, and how it's marked here in Maryland comes with its own traditions and rituals. To tell us more about what happened in Maryland and how Juneteenth is marked, Dr. Ida E. Jones is joining us from her office at Morgan State University. Ida is the Associate Director of Special Collections and the University Archivist at Morgan State. Dr. Jones, thanks you so much and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so very much.
Great to have you here to talk about this. Many of us know many things about slavery, but before we get into emancipation here in Maryland, is there something you find that people are leaving out or not realizing about the slave trade? You said the system flourished for 400 years, enriching Europe, draining Africa, and cultivating the Americas.
Yes, that's very important for us to understand. The inhumanity of the entire chattel slave system was a great blot on the humanity of all things. However, it's very important to understand the economy is what drove the inhumanity. There was money that basically was fed by the black bodies of African people who were stolen and trafficked in a triangular fashion from the continent of Africa across the Atlantic and sending resources back to Europe. So the triangulation of the using of African bodies to enrich nations and countries that are still profiting from the wealth of that system is very important to understand. It was an economic system, but it was also enraptured or embroiled with an inhumane treatment of a people.
Now, the Emancipation Proclamation, which President Lincoln signed, that went into effect on January 1st, 1863. D.C. at the time was maybe about a two-hour train trip from Baltimore. So for an enslaved person in Baltimore when that day came, what did it mean for them and how did they find out?
Well, Baltimore is very unique because it held the largest free antebellum or pre-Civil War population. So for African Americans who were living in Baltimore proper, a much smaller city than it is now, was one that already had experienced the duality of both enslavement and freedom. So both of those kind of contextual ways of living existed in Baltimore City. There is the African American Methodist Church, or the AME Church, that's going to celebrate very richly the idea of what's going to happen in that January, that you're going to wake up free as a people. So there was great jubilation and very much a lot of excitement in terms of meeting that new day as free people, wholly all African people.
And just to clarify that point for everybody who may not know, the Emancipation Proclamation basically affected people who were in the United States at the time. Considering the Confederacy did not consider itself a part of the United States, enslaved people in those parts of the country were not affected by the Emancipation Proclamation, but would be by the time the war ended in 1865.
Great historical point. Thank you for bringing that clarity.
Just for those who may not be totally aware of it, and that's what we try to do. I know you have a picture from the Maryland State Archives of black people in Baltimore celebrating Ratification Day. It's from May 19th, 1870, 7 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Black men in top hats on horses and black women in large Victorian dresses. People are in formation like it's a parade. Is this an organized event? It looks like it was. Tell us a little more, bit more about it.
It was called Ratification Day in 1870. But let's just go back a little bit. When we think about Juneteenth, we celebrate this as Emancipation Day for everyone. There are multiple Emancipation Day programs going around the country because there were different dates for different states. So in Maryland, in Baltimore City in particular, the Ratification Day of 1870s, when the 15th Amendment was ratified to the Constitution, empowering all men, regardless of their station or stature, the right to vote. Not just black men. People always say, well, black men were the right. No, all men. Those who did not have property. Those who were not included in the 1% that were holding it down prior to. So the ratification of this amendment definitely celebrated the citizenship, full citizenship of black men, as well as other property-less men. And so, yes, you see here, right in front of the Washington Monument, a parade that was epic in terms of all of the organizations, all of the religious organizations, civic organizations, and communities celebrating the ratification of the 50th Amendment, the final one of the Civil War amendments, the 13th abolishing slavery, the 14th giving equal protection under the law, and then the 50th Amendment, the final one, giving the franchise to men.
You tracked down other artifacts immortalizing emancipation celebrations in Maryland. What else did you find?
Well, I found one that was in a remote part of Western Maryland where they had parades. And these parades flourished in various hamlets, cities, and villages around the country. And unfortunately, by the 1940s and 50s, with zoning laws and the creation of the highway structures, a lot of black communities were decimated during that time period. So they celebrated, usually with church, these parades, in terms of memorializing the idea of emancipation. In the African-American Christian tradition, the whole idea of New Year's Eve into New Year's Day is called Watch Night, and that really has its origin story in the whole idea of waiting for that night to see that dawn of the emancipation. So that celebration starts in the church. It then germinates into community festivals that actually had parades and banners and floats in various cities. I forget the name of the county in the city, so please do forgive me, Maryland, in regards to not having the actual name. But these city situations, if you read the black press, small ink is covering these opportunities where they celebrate community. And along with the idea of the floats and the parades and the bands, and was a sense of pride that we have come this far and we're going to go much further.
There was also National Freedom Day. Major Richard R. Wright Sr., a formerly enslaved person who became a banker, formed an association which led to the declaration of the holiday in 1949. Now, that holiday may not be part of the national consciousness now. Is it something you found people celebrating?
They have had a resurrection of these things. So we want to really commemorate and thank Loretta Carter Haynes, who was responsible for bringing that back to Washington, D.C. in the 1960s and 70s. And then, of course, our national mother of all, Miss Opal Lee, who really crusaded personally. She's in her ninth, I believe, decade of living. And for the past 20 years has personally crusaded to bring to the nation's consciousness a federal holiday acknowledging all Emancipation Days and capping it with Juneteenth.
I'm Opal Lee, and I've had this marvelous day at the White House. The young people would say, it's off the chain. I knew I was coming because Juneteenth had been made a national holiday, and the president was signing the bill into law, and I was invited.
So these two women in particular, along with other women around the country, have been principally the responsible parties of consciously bringing to our remembrance and memory the idea of Emancipation Day. So when we look at the picture that is part of the Corpus Bettman archives, and then you see this idea of this Freedom Day, we're going to see centered in the picture is one Mary McLeod Bethune, who is the 15th of 17 children born to enslaved parentage. And so as a result, it had a personal principal effect in her life, having had parents and older siblings who were enslaved. This is the 1940s. And so there are individuals who are living at this particular time who had been children and grandchildren of enslaved people. The gentleman to her right is a man named William Henry Jernigan, who was very involved in the National Baptist Convention. He's born in 1869. His father was born in 1821. So it's very interesting to see what's happening with the idea of the human bridge that leads from enslavement to freedom and emancipation to the 20th century. And now in the 21st century, the great-greats or third and fourth great-grandchildren of formerly enslaved people celebrating and taking homage to acknowledge that chattel system, the inhumanity, and the economic depravity that led to emancipation.
And to see that photo that Dr. Jones is referring to, go to our website, WIPR.org. Certainly something to look at. It's fascinating. Your interest is history, historian, but with a few hours left on Juneteenth, tell us a little more about it.
I think all of us should be celebrating the holiday in terms of just taking a pause and learning about the history. We have become amnesia victims in the 21st century because everything is so instantaneous and disposable. We are celebrating our semi-sesquicentennial. The country itself is 250 years old. We have a lot to be proud for as Americans, and there's also an underbelly that's very ugly and a point of dishonor. But we have to acknowledge both elements of the sphere of America because that keeps us balanced. We have opportunity and possibility for greatness when we acknowledge the full narrative of the American experience. Africans weren't the only ones who were basically maligned and mistreated. There were Japanese internments. There were other white ethnic groups that were interred. There has been gender discrimination. There's been ableism. So we have within human nature the ability to be destructive. But in the midst of that destruction, we also have the capacity to be beautiful and constructive. So if for anything, irrespective of one's particular connection to enslavement or Juneteenth, it should be a pause for all Americans, not just for the federal holiday, but to really pause and really analyze and really think about, who am I as an American? What does my citizenship mean to me? And how do I enrich my experience and enrich my understanding of our forebears and then also my stewardship of this American citizenship into the 21st century?
Another thing we'll be celebrating this weekend is the 50th anniversary of AFRAM. We can tell from the shirt you're wearing you're going to be heading over there. What sorts of things are you looking forward to seeing this weekend?
I'm very excited with AFRAM. It is their 50th anniversary of a cultural event that invites all of Baltimore City. I'm excited for everything. And the weather is going to be amazing because it was been so hot the last 2 years. I've volunteered for the past 3 years, but this weekend is supposed to be in the 80s. I can deal with that. And it should be some great weather, great snacks, great food, and once again, a great time to once again celebrate our humanity and the beauty within our culture.
We're going to be talking more about the history of AFRAM later in the show. Dr. Ida E. Jones is the Associate Director of the Special Collections and the University Archivist at Morgan State University. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking with us.
Thank you so much as well.
Stay with us. We'll have more on the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Now this short break.
You're listening to 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, where support comes from the Maryland State Board of Elections. Maryland's primary election is June 23rd. Vote-by-mail ballots must be postmarked or placed in a drop box by Election Day. More information at vote.md.gov/vote2026.
Practical Parenting, the new podcast from GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches to find joy in the process and thrive through it all. The goal? To ensure parents have the resources, support, and confidence they need. Practical Parenting from GBMC. Available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
When the big night came, I marched up to the microphone. And I said, my name is Alexis Barton, and my motto is, it's not what you're called, it's what you answer to. And they bought it.
Join us next time for stories of American dreams, beauty pageants, homemade cakes, and intergenerational farming. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
You can listen to the Moth Radio Hour every Saturday at 2 in the afternoon here on WIPR, where support comes from Be More Paddle, a new paddle sports wellness complex bringing the global all-ages sport to Maryland. Hosting Maryland's first professional tournament on Saturday, June 20th. Open to the public. More information at bmorepadel.com.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WIPR Newsroom. We've been talking about Juneteenth on the show today, but June is also Black Music Month. As part of our programming, we're airing two specials this Sunday about Black music artists throughout the last century. We hear how rock and roll almost forgot its early Black artists and slipped into being a primarily white music genre.
By the time Jimi Hendrix died in 1970, people thought it was totally crazy that there was a black man playing electric lead guitar. Like, one of his obituaries refers to him as a, quote, black man in the alien world of rock. So he's being positioned almost literally as an outsider. No one thought it was strange when Chuck Berry was playing rock music or rock and roll music in, you know, 10 years earlier. Like, what happens? What accounts for that shift where Jimi Hendrix becomes the exceptional figure, you know, the only one, essentially?
And we'll hear about the early black rock artists that don't get as much attention as their white contemporaries. It's a special episode from With Good Reason, a show that makes scholarly work accessible to all, featuring Slate pop critic Jack Hamilton and hosted by Sarah McCormick. We'll also be airing an interview with Rhiannon Giddens, folk musician and artistic director of Silk Road, now a teaser from the rock and roll special all about King of Soul, Sam Cooke.
Sam Cooke is, I think, really one of the most fascinating American musicians of the 20th century. He was the first gospel singer to successfully cross over to the pop charts, and he did it with a song called You Send Me, which came out in 1958 and became a number one hit, still extremely famous song. We can listen to a little bit of it right here.
Darling, you send me.
This is not a piece of music that sounds like gospel music. This is a piece of music that sounds like basically a teenage love song from the late 1950s. In Sam Cooke's crossover, this was actually the market that he was really coveting. He makes a bunch of songs like Wonderful World, Only 16, Cupid. But Sam Cooke's pop output has often been seen as sort of lightweight and disposable by people. But in actuality, I think that what it's showing is that Sam Cooke was this incredibly versatile musician. A piece I'd really like to talk a little bit about is a song called The Change Is Gonna Come, which is probably Sam Cooke's most famous composition that he wrote in 1963, inspired by Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, which had come out that same year. I'll play a bit of A Change Is Gonna Come right now.
I was born. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Isn't that great?
So there's a number of, like, just fantastic things about this recording, and one of which is Sam Cooke's voice, which is among the most beautiful ever heard on earth. But, I mean, this is, you know, it goes on to be, it's very transparently a song about civil rights. I mean, this is a definitively avant-garde piece of music. There's no other piece of music prior to this that really sounded like it. It's Sam Cooke making this really, really powerful artistic and political statement.
Are you saying in some ways Sam Cooke is as great as Bob Dylan?
Oh, absolutely.
But not as widely recognized.
No, certainly not. I mean, right now there are two full-length books out there about Sam Cooke. There's close to 300 full books out there written about Bob Dylan.
That was Slate pop critic Jack Hamilton speaking with Sarah McCormick on a special episode of With Good Reason. To hear more about rock's shift into a predominantly white genre and the demise of the Negro baseball leagues happening at the same time.
The resonance this game had within the communities, the solidarity around this black-owned, black-operated system is now gone.
Tune in to WYPR this Sunday, June 21st at 6:30 p.m. And tune in earlier at 6 to hear the National Endowment of the Arts interview with folk musician and opera singer Rhiannon Giddens.
Hey, Miss Collins, ain't it hard? See young Lewis in that old graveyard.
After a quick break, we pass the mic to Abdu Mongo Ali, a Baltimore-based rapper, poet, and artist. They reflect on Between Every Breath, There Is Atmosphere, their piece commissioned this year, and they also tell us how they got their start writing poetry and compositions in fifth grade. AFRAM is coming up this weekend. We're celebrating 50 years of the festival. I'm Matt Bush. This is the WYPR News Roundup. Stay with us.
You are tuned in to 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, where support comes from Alternative Roofing, Inc., a locally owned roofing company since 2004. Alternative Roofing has been providing roofing, siding, and gutters to Maryland residences and businesses for over 20 years. More information at AlternativeRoofingInc.com.
Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair September 13th. First, it's Pop Princesses with Enzlo at 11:30. Pitch perfect hits from Taylor, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and many more. Then at 2:30, it's a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with singers backed by a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both September 13th. Tickets on sale now include fair admission. Details at WTMD.org.
Hi, I'm Wamboi Kamau, a reporter here at WIPR. And lately, I've been hearing from you.
I enjoy your reporting and all the other people as well. My only complaint is some of the reporters forget adverbs exist. And I find myself verbally correcting the radio.
We take your feedback seriously. Our words should be accurately and properly modified. And thanks to listeners like you who critique us lovingly and support us generously, we're still here. Donate today at WIPR.org. Thanks. Sincerely.
Welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Abdu Mongo Ali is a rapper, poet, and sound artist who's been making music inspired by Baltimore throughout their career. Earlier this year, the Baltimore Museum of Art named them Composer in Residence and premiered their work, Between Every Breath, There Is Atmosphere. In that composition, Ali explored how the land, sky, and water of this part of the world shape Black Marylanders' relationship with nature. You'll hear excerpts of that music as we pass the mic to Abdu Mongo Ali.
Pass the Mic is made possible by a grant from the T. Rowe Price Foundation, recognizing 45 years of advancing thriving communities and building financial well-being. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not reflect the views of the T. Rowe Price Foundation, T. Rowe Price, or any of their subsidiaries or affiliates.
Pass the mic.
Hand that to me.
Pass it over here.
Pass the mic.
Pass the Mic is a community-driven radio show that gives you the space to share your stories, your issues, and your concerns your way. Today we pass the mic to rapper, sound artist, and poet Abdu Mongo Ali, who reflects on the transformative moments that shaped their career.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise.
I was in the fifth grade. You know how they always do some type of lo-fi production for graduations. And we all recited lines from Maya Angelou's Still I Rise poem.
You may shoot me with your words. Oh, this is my part. This is my part that I did. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness. But still, like air, I rise.
Very powerful, strong words for a 10-year-old to take in. I think that was when maybe I caught the bug of when you get on stage and you do your thing.
My name is Abdu Mongo Ali, and I am a electronic musician, poet, and cross-disciplinary artist.
I stand in ocean.
While writing poetry in undergrad, I was heavily also writing raps. And I met DDM, who was really getting his name out there at the time in Baltimore. And I think seeing him and then TT the Artist, both queer Black music artists, made me feel like I can maybe do this. And so I wrote these lyrics and I hit up this producer, Shorts. Once he got me on that mic and I rapped the lyrics to my first song, Banji Music, I felt like I was a new person. Like, I felt liberated, I felt empowered. Right then and there, I was like, I'm gonna do this music thing. The Baltimore Museum of Art hit me up. We want you to be the inaugural composer in residence. I was like, what? Okay. We have a theme centered around creating awareness through art about environmentalism. And I haven't really thought about those themes in my work before, but everything is connected. So I didn't really feel intimidated. I did a lot of electronic music production, but I also worked alongside two instrumentalists, the Negoni, and some experimental guitar playing. And also I had my own percussive instruments to play with, like the cowrie shell, and also a piece of sheet metal and chain. The way we think, our emotions, our mood swings, everything is influenced and informed by the atmospheric conditions that we inhabit, the air, the landscapes, the way the sun points at us, how that affects who we are as mid-Atlantic beings. And when it comes to thinking about Black people's relationship with nature, and I mean, it's a broad, abstract question, but what is it today, especially as we are in a world that is rooted in creating a dissonance between us and the land, and in a world that's heavily wrapped up in technology that is not about bringing us closer to nature?
Pass the Mic is a presentation of Baltimore Public Media, produced by Elizabeth Nonemaker, senior producer Mallory Pinkard-Pierre, and executive producer Amy Walters.
Learn more about their music and poetry at AbdulAli.com. They're performing at the Current Space this evening alongside other artists as part of the Juneteenth Soul of Tomorrow program. Music featured in this piece included Between Every Breath, There Is Atmosphere, and Banji Music, shared courtesy of the artist and the Baltimore Museum of Art. And if you want to hear more from Pass the Mic, visit our website, WYPR.org, or listen and subscribe to Pass the Mic wherever you get podcasts. Up next on the News Roundup, AFRAM, 50 years this weekend.
Good afternoon. You are listening to WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1, where support comes from Wells Discount Liquors, family-owned since 1937. Wells offers a collection of wines, beer, spirits, and ready-to-drink cocktails for the summer season. Located at 6310 York Road and online at wellswine.com.
Hey there, John Lee here, and I cover Baltimore County for WYPR. This spring, I reported on a slew of political races, county council members getting themselves tied up in knots over their pensions, and on the Pikesville High School grad who brought us, wait for it, the musical Wicked. Your donation makes it possible for me to bring Baltimore County stories to you. Please consider making a donation before June 30th so that WYPR can end our fiscal year strong. You can donate online at WYPR.org. And thank you.
If you work for the federal courts, your right to blow the whistle on workplace discrimination is limited. A look at how the courts police themselves on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs Monday through Friday at 4 in the afternoon here on WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, where support comes from Sinai Hospital of Baltimore and the Alvin and Lois Lapidus Cancer Institute, ushering in a new era of cancer care at the Weinman Cancer Building, opening July 2026. More information at lifebridgehealth.org/cancer.
Welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of our award-winning news team. So we spent some time this hour talking about the struggle to get to Juneteenth, the history of it, good, the bad, and everything in between. Now it's time for the party. It's AFRAM, 50 years of AFRAM. In 1976, bedecked in Barrymore tapered collars, three-piece suits, tunics, and lots of bell-bottoms, Gil Scott-Heron, the Green Sisters, Lou Rawls, and Emergency Landing graced the stage at Hopkins Plaza, and the crowd went wild. This weekend, Charlie Wilson, The Lox, Drew Hill, SWV, and Mario will be just some of the acts that you can catch on the stage in Druid Hill Park for free. So to talk to us about the culture turning golden, the AFRAM theme this year, we have two reporters from our news partners, the Baltimore Banner, with us in the studio right now, Jasmine Vaughn Hall and Wesley Case. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, you've been working on a series of stories about this half-century celebration of AFRAM for the Baltimore Banner. Encourage everybody to check them out. One you dropped on Tuesday has some absolutely amazing photos of the original years of AFRAM taking place down in the Inner Harbor. What kind of led you to want to look at the history of this outside of just turning 50, and what have you uncovered?
I mean, to be honest, I think everybody today knows what AFRAM is, but nobody really knows how it got started. So it is actually really interesting to be able to look at old newspaper clips and kind of who was a part of the original organizing. Unfortunately, there was like a 26-member committee. There's probably like one or two people who are still around to be able to talk to us about it. And it was really just really cool to see that this kind of trickled down from a war on poverty campaign. And basically at Dunbar High School, there was a parent club who was already pushing for cultural arts throughout Baltimore, but specifically in that corner of East Baltimore. And at the same time, Baltimore in the 1960s would get funding for the Model Cities program, which is under the Lyndon B. Johnson campaign. And then there was also a Soul Fest that was happening in Baltimore as well, which also fed into just the contributions that Black people had in Baltimore. And kind of those concepts merged a little bit when Norman E. Ross put in this proposal for AFRAM. So that's kind of how we got to AFRAM.
Yeah, it was a long, winding road to get to 50. Change of locations, change of names. And yeah, it's just a story of resiliency and a celebration of Black life in Baltimore.
How much was this city different in 1976 as it is now when this festival started? I know there's a lot of differences, but there's still a lot of things that are the same, haven't really changed much or anything like that, for good and bad. So look, taking us back to 1976, the first year of the festival, America's bicentennial year, beginning of William Donald Schaefer's era as mayor of Baltimore. What was the city like as this festival was birthed?
I mean, I think one of the things that is super apparent is Baltimore is still dealing with the aftermath of redlining. This is basically the birthplace of redlining. We're still dealing with just the backlash of redlining today. Bethlehem Steel was laying off thousands and thousands of workers, which was a big thing for Baltimore because a lot of people worked there. The population was declining, which we're seeing that kind of come back today, but that's just within the most recent years. And I mean, to be honest, I think for Black Baltimoreans, they were still reeling from the riots from the death of Martin Luther King. So there are a lot of different things at play here, and it's understandable why people would want to come together and show that Black people have major contributions not only to Baltimore, but to America itself.
Yeah, I see a through line, though, of music and culture being a huge part of AFRAM from the very beginning. Like you mentioned, Lou Rawls and Gil Scott-Heron, I mean, huge names for the inaugural. And I think that's been a point of emphasis for the city throughout the decades. I spoke with Mayor Brandon Scott, and he talked about seeing Patti LaBelle multiple times through the decades. He shouted out LL Cool J, Dougie Fresh. I mean, and like you said, Charlie Wilson coming this year, 14-time Grammy nominee. So, yeah, I think there's always been a strong emphasis on the music component.
How many of these early partygoers from the original AFRAMs were you able to track down, and did they tell you, was it better then or is it better now?
Honestly, we were only able to track down one key person, and that was Alma Bell, who was on the original planning committee from 1976. And she was actually a part of one of the war on poverty organizations that came about during that time. And she really talked about how, you know, she's not necessarily going to all of the AFRAMs these days. She's in her 80s, I mean, but she's glad that they were able to create something that is contemporary and is adaptable and can cater to each audience of every year, every decade. And she's actually really, really happy that it's still something that people anticipate, that's still active, and that's still very Baltimore.
Another person you interviewed was Baltimore artist Akio Evans about AFRAM, and he talked about Black celebrities just hanging out.
You have people like Richard Pryor and Red Fox that my uncle used to open up for, that these people would actually walk through Baltimore City, you get what I'm saying, as normal, you know what I mean? So for me, AFRAM has always been something that you can identify, and I was always looked towards seeing it, because granted, back in the day, we didn't have like the Black Panthers movies. We didn't have like things that we've seen on screen. So when you actually see people come together, you know what I mean, in real time, live, I feel like that was something that I've always appreciated.
Now, it's not a big surprise that AFRAM has changed over the years in terms of how many people attended, kind of ebbs and flows, but also where it's been held. It's been held kind of all over the city in many different parts. It's now in Druid Hill Park.
So at first it was in Hopkins Plaza in Charles Center for a couple of years, I want to say, in the beginning. But it's been at Rash Field. It's been at Camden Yards. It's honestly moved 9 or 10 times at the least, which, to be honest, I think for some people that maybe deterred them a little bit from attending every single year. But now it's been at Drew Hill pretty consistently, and I think it's kind of like that's just where people know it's going to be.
It had a rocky start with Druid Hill Park. In 2017, then Mayor Catherine Pugh moved it from Camden Yards to Druid Hill Park, and she really downsized it. She said that she wanted to make it a more kind of locally focused event, so there wasn't the big name headliners. And the backlash to it was swift, and attendance was down to, I believe, 4,000 that year. So I think it was a point of emphasis for Mayor Scott when he took office to elevate the event again.
And part of that is moving it to Juneteenth weekend out of August. One of the reasons why it's too hot in August, obviously, Artscape has also moved out of August too, for similar but different reasons. One thing, though, that really stands out with AFRAM is all the music. And the artists who have been there every year, your stories look so much into all the long history of musical acts that have come to Baltimore for AFRAM. Tell us just a minute, a little bit more about those.
Yeah, I think there's been a very nice balance of local music. I was talking to Mighty Mark, the legendary Baltimore club producer, and he made sure to point out that he really appreciated that Mayor Scott had dedicated programming to Baltimore Club, which is our strain of house music. It was very frenetic and very fast-paced and just a lot of fun. It's a balance of local and then headliners too. Last year, JT of the City Girls performed, Juvenile performed with a full band, which was amazing. it was a party out there at Druid Hill Park that year. And it will be this year too. Ultra Nate, who's another house legend who somehow hasn't performed at AFRAM before, but she's going to have a full band filled with all Baltimore musicians. So she's looking forward to it.
A big celebration, really, of the city and its culture, and in particular, its Black culture. You guys are both going to the festival this weekend. What are you most looking forward to seeing?
I really want to see Chloe Bailey and Normani. I think that they're great performers, great energy, and I think they pair really well with what AFRAM is about.
I mean, as a rap fan, I can't miss an excuse to see The Lox. J-Kiss is one of my favorite rappers. But then, yeah, Mario 2, SWV, I mean, was the first cassette tape I ever had. Week is one of the great songs ever. And Drew Hill getting added last minute is such a win for the festival.
Jasmine Vaughn Hall and Wesley Case are both reporters with our news partners, the Baltimore Banner. They've been looking into the 50-year history of the AFRAM Festival, which takes place this weekend at Druid Hill Park. Thank you both so much for coming in, and enjoy yourselves this weekend.
Thanks.
And that's it for the WIPR News Roundup this week. Next week, we're going to have primary election results. Let us know your thoughts on who won and who didn't win. I'm Matt Bush, the news director at WIPR. Isaac Moss, Elizabeth Nonemaker, and Mallory Pinkard-Pierre helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are our studio engineers. And A.B. Walters is WIPR's executive producer. Thanks for listening. Have a great Juneteenth weekend.